Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a good animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello, and welcome to Bookworm. Today I'm in a tickled state because one of my favorite writers and favorite friends, Anne Beattie, is with me. The occasion is the publication of her new and selected stories, Park City, from Knopf. This book represents a culling from the books of short stories, Distortions, Secrets and Surprises, The Burning House, Where You'll Find Me, and What Was Mine. She's the author as well of the novels Chilly Scenes of Winter, Falling in Place, Love Always, Picturing Will, Another You, and My Life, starring Dara Falcon. And it's very good to see you. Thank you for coming.
Thanks.
I wanted to begin because, you know, I've spent years now mumbling abstract theories of how your stories come together. And while I know that I have to account for these things, I also know that you're the most intuitive writer I know. And I wanted to ask you about that mixture of intuition and planning, because when it comes to me, mm-hmm. I see it as extremely patterned and designed. Mm-hmm. But from your side, you've always expressed it as something that arrived from the brow untouched.
Well, it's interesting because in the moment it can genuinely seem that you're selecting something that's random. But as, you know, the work proceeds, I think that whether you want to or not, you begin to realize, well, no, that wasn't a random detail. And so, you know, you stop and question yourself, well, why the moon as opposed to the sun? What might I have been on? So there comes a point when the story changes and when you do get on to your symbols, if you will. But what I usually start with is something imagistic. And, you know, a physical scene, a landscape, whatever, a tree, not even as much as a landscape. And that thing poses a question. And then I guess it is intuition. At some subconscious level, I clearly have associations that seem right for the world of the story as opposed to right if you and I were just having a conversation and I meant to describe what it looks like where I live or something like that.
Because, you know, it seems to me that these stories are about arrangement. You know, that they end up being extraordinary arrangements of the items that have fallen into their purview.
Well, I think that they wouldn't, and some of them go astray, and some of them don't exist at all because they don't tend to take on any kind of coherence. I mean, I can be honest about that. But as I say, when something starts to give me a glimmer of what is going on there at a kind of subconscious level for the writer, I can begin to shape it a bit. It's not as though I stop and think, well, at this point I could write an essay. It's almost as though at this point I could begin to deconstruct what I've done. It's more like that.
Lori Moore, in a very perceptive piece in the New York Times, talks about the passive woman at the center of the story who, in a sense, is suffering but not exactly participating in the story because she is so busy recording its details. And I wondered about that pile-up of information and detail that almost, you know, you were in the first book, Distortions, the person who blew everyone away with first paragraphs that told more than most novels.
Well, that's nice. That's nice to hear. She certainly got a point there. Yes, and to some extent, I'm sure that whether I want to or not, I'm projecting somewhat onto these characters. But it would be very hard for me to have an always astute, reasoning narrator because the stories would become very didactic, really. That's a very hard personality type to deal with in fiction, you know. And if you do, usually you have to reveal that over time. I don't think you can just jump in with someone who perceives at that particular level. Because, as I say, you would have that essayish quality to it. So I may, in rough drafts, even dumb it down a bit, really, just to create the character. Like, I may very well know what my habitual response to something would be or what I have habitually observed about others' responses. But then the question is, well, if this was the one time they didn't respond that way, how might they respond and would that make sense, you know?
Well, it's sort of, I was looking for the word for it, and normally, one talks about what you do as storytelling, but I thought that this really might be called story guessing, that the characters, even within the story, sort of respond with extraordinary hypotheses about what stories other people would like to hear. One of the husbands in the new story says of a boy completely unrelated, he's my adoptive son. Mm-hmm. And they spend the rest of the scene seeing how that would play out.
Yeah.
And when the father is tired of doing this, the boy takes it on. He wants it now. And this goes on in every imaginable way. A person in a bar says, "You don't want to sit next to us. I'm gay and you don't like our kind." And the woman with him says, "No, he's upset right now. He's really my husband. He's upset because I'm leaving him." And, you know, after a while, you realize that any version of the story could be true.
Yeah, any version could be true, and sometimes it takes a second character to comment and to do something really that's the opposite of what's expedient, you know. I have to say that also is something that I do. I mean, I'm really a pretty good actress, and I'm pretty good at saying something with an extremely straight face and having people entirely believe it. So that, too, I suppose, is just, you know, a tick. I mean, it's fun. It is fun to see what will happen if you're sitting at a bar and you say something really by complete non sequitur to the person sitting next to you.
Okay, Ann, tell me a story.
I'll tell you a story, actually. This one will really amaze you. I'll try to make it very short, although it's a 4-hour story. I was on book tour with André Dubus, who has a wonderful book out of essays now. And so we were the dynamic duo, and they had hired, as you know, André is a double amputee and lost one leg and pretty much the use of another when he got out of his car on the highway in Boston to aid somebody who was having trouble and was hit by another car. And this was, I don't know, it was about 12 years ago, I would guess. And he gets around a bit by wheelchair, but this is clearly not an easy matter. Here's my story. André and I were doing a reading in Connecticut in the afternoon. And when we got out, the friend of his who came along for the ride and I and André's wheelchair, André's footrest, André's everything were put into the back of a Carry limousine. And we set off for André's house, and I was going to be dropped off along the way. My husband was going to pick me up. And an hour into the drive, the limousine broke down. And what happened first was that, I mean, this is horrible because it's categorically, it's like reliving this nightmare of what had happened to him. We heard this horrible noise in the car. It sounded like an airplane was landing on top of us. Then we heard metal as though, you know, the car was being melded into the road or something like that. We got over to the right-hand side, and the limousine driver, who handled it as best he could, called Carrie Carr to say, you know, certainly at the very least, this was dreadful and we needed to be rescued. We never were. But the first person on the scene was a Rhode Island cop who looked like, I mean, I actually said to André, "Do you think parts of his body are metal?" I mean, he really looked like RoboCop approaching the car. And he said, "Well, I'll give you a push to a safer place on the highway." And, you know, we assumed this was just the beginning of things. Talk about stories that never end. A push meant that he put his car in reverse and hit the limo with the steering paralyzed at about 40 miles an hour, and we went flying down the highway with the driver unable to steer. Really, this happened. And then, you know, I mean, this would just go on longer than your radio broadcast, but we found ourselves at the side of the highway, you know, sitting on the back of the trunk and sitting on André's footrest and André sitting in this wheelchair and somebody else sitting in that and so forth for 4 hours while no one rescued us, and we never, ever saw another cop again. So as a story, it's really a non-story, but from moment to moment when you're in that, your mind is just racing as to the truly endless possibilities of what if, you know? And that's a very overt example. But on a lesser scale, when things really don't make sense, and therefore that's why I'm writing about them, it's the same thing. It's what if. Who would believe this if I told the story that the last, you know, somebody in a wheelchair ever saw of a Rhode Island cop was when the guy saluted and drove past the car and continued on? End of story. It's very bad literature.
It's so hard for me to accept this idea that for you it comes naturally. And I think that for years, many people... I think mm-hmm. that you are suffering at this point from having announced joyfully how easily it came, and I think now people are beating you up for that.
Yeah.
But the congruent thing is that it comes naturally, and to my eye at least, these are such instinctively well-composed stories with so much in them that a reader like me is very hard put to find them as casual as you say they are. What part do you consider to be the gift?
The gift of the story or the gift to me when I'm writing
it? The gift to you, the gift that came to you as a writer, because it seems like, what is work and what is the gift?
I think part of the gift is being able to choose quickly, you know? I think a lot of people can choose, but they don't choose in the moment, and so they have to go back to it or they have to research it. I suppose to some extent it's intuition in that I'm putting my hands, my mind more than my hands, on what I can go to quickly so that I don't lose any momentum as a writer. But in fact, in life, I'm extremely decisive. If anything, I'm so decisive that I arrive at decisions so quickly that perhaps I don't give enough thought to alternatives, you know. But in writing, I think to keep the trajectory, at least for me, I couldn't possibly think of alternatives. I'd have to take what seemed in the moment to be inevitable.
I'm speaking to Ann Beattie upon the publication of her new and selected stories, Park City, from Knopf. This is Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm. Now, once you've gotten through a story, at what point is it, in fact, a story? At what point does enough happen in it?
Well, then again, you know, I'm the final factor there in that it's like saying, well, if you were conversing with someone, at what point would you stand up and say, well, it's been fun talking to you, but I really have to go to bed now, you know? It's the same kind of almost physical feeling that you know enough, you've done enough in some ways. And it's that physical feeling, I think, that precedes, in effect, you know, putting an ending on it, really.
How do you know beyond the demonstration of extraordinary virtuosity and memory that the story coheres?
Well, I guess I'm trusting that, you know, like a magnet, once these things are there, that they can pull other things in the story toward them. But a lot of things are always put aside, too, because, as I say, they don't have their own gravitational field, you know. It's necessary that they do a lot of work, and if I don't begin to see, well, this piece of the puzzle relates to that piece of the puzzle, and I can, in effect, suggest the connection, put that piece of sky in something else, maybe, you know.
Well, it's fascinating, because I think that in the dark of the imagination, if you'll pardon a grotesque phrase, that something happens without exactly your knowing it. For instance, when I was reading Windy Day at the Reservoir, when they arrive at the house is dark, there are mosquitoes about, so they're slapping at mosquitoes they can't see, mm-hmm. and then they do the next thing. They reach out for a light switch, which turns out to be a chain, and it's not a light that comes on, but a fan that comes on, so that almost everything they're doing in the dark of this house involves the slapping out at or reaching up for something that turns out not to be there, which eventually becomes, this is the art, I think, of the story, the spiritual condition of the characters. All instinctive?
Well, yes, I think so, except probably, you know, what began with instinct has become training now in some way. In other words, it doesn't get me very far if a character walks into a room and pulls a cord and the light comes on. It does really, as the writer, get me a bit farther if unexpectedly the fan comes on. I mean, that's actually on some level a slightly upsetting thing, you know, if that happens. But therefore, you can use it. How can you use, if a light bulb is burned out? I mean, that's more humdrum in a story than it is in real life. So I think also I'm very surprised, too. I don't know until the character pulls that string exactly what's going to happen, you know.
Because, you know, the first story in this collection, which is one of the new stories, Cosmos, has so many of these moments that happen so quickly that it feels like you're having a heart attack. I mean, this really feels
flattering.
Like the room is revolving around you as you're losing consciousness. I mean, I've never seen a story move so fast.
Wow. Great.
So is it that, you know, you say that now it's training and you know what you need, but are there things that you do to simulate randomness at this point, since you know eventually it's going to go here?
You know, I really couldn't answer that, honestly. I mean, really, the answer is that perhaps I do, but I'm not onto myself in that way. I don't mean either that I'm just going from, you know, specific thing to specific thing in the story, and that unless they are other than what you would expect, the story wouldn't proceed. I mean, I think as the story, as the details accrue, they're getting closer to the emotion of the story, too. So there's something not quite as measurable as the things themselves, you know, that begins to seem to have a rooted quality. I mean, the emotion you can feel looking at something, and then you fill in the details. Then you say, well, I felt this way at Yellowstone, and I can now point to X, Y, and Z. But, you know, it works in that more general way, too.
The cover of this book is a painting by Lincoln Perry, your husband. And I wondered, it's all in variations on two colors. Mm-hmm. And it could be described as an abstract arrangement of orange and blues.
Mm-hmm.
Except that it's an abstract arrangement of orange and blues that turns out to be a picture of three people either sleeping or half asleep, dressed and undressed in ways that are simultaneous. One is both dressed and undressed. The paint is an imposition of the dress on her.
Right.
Sometimes I have trouble finding the legs, the second leg of a one-legged woman, and then see that it's naturally in an unnatural position.
Mm-hmm.
And as I look at this painting, I find myself describing it the way I describe your work, that that these are arrangements of certain kinds of words, that the poses that may look like a party may in fact be awake or in fact some sort of death scene, that somehow or other everything has been arranged so that things are realistic but at the same time formal. They seem to describe a set group of events but with enormous ambivalence, so that you can bring so much projection onto the states of mind that you keep creating a larger universe out of this story. How do you fit together? Can you describe the formal versus contentual balances in your stories?
First of all, I'm still reeling from a very good description of Lincoln's work, and I suppose we do have that shared sensibility. I mean, I think that's what he is. He's doing group figure composition, and there they are on some level. Yes, they're recognizable figures, but it is his own sensibility, I'm sure, that makes him need to have them move toward abstraction as much as they move toward, you know, being more realistic. And I'd never really thought about it that way before, but I think that really is something that influences my work in some way, that it's not just the individual pieces themselves that might have a kind of odd vibration to them, but that in some ways I want the story to fall apart at the same time that it's being made, you know? And I've actually, I mean, a story like The Working Girl or something like that from one of the previous collections is really a deconstruction of how a story is written. And on some level, I agree with you, Cosmos, which is unusually antic in terms of the way things happen, really gives you an emotional feeling of everything being in fragments. So internally, you feel one way, whereas the, as it were, surface of the story is something else. It might proceed oddly, but it does have a linear movement in mm-hmm. some way. It moves from the beginning to the end, and it is in that way linear.
Now, this is a collection of over 25 years of writing. When you were assembling it, were you able to locate things that you thought had changed or developed? And in the pieces that, in essence, you left behind, were there traits that you no longer liked?
Traits that I no longer liked? I found it sometimes, even in stories that I thought generally succeeded on their own terms, maybe, that there was a bit of a pulled back quality that was, it wasn't really expedient. It was the best I could do in the moment. You know, it was the best I could do to articulate some kind of confusion that I wasn't quite sure I was confused about. I think now I understand perfectly well what I'm confused about, and I have to, you know, restrain myself from getting that aspect of my personality into the stories. But yes, I mean, I understand what people are saying sometimes when they speak about the coolness or the aloof quality of the stories. I think that although it isn't of any interest to me to do this, I mean, if I were to go back into them again, there probably is more of an alternative viewpoint than I ever realized at the moment that I was writing the story. For example, I'm sure that I could and would be tempted to write Cosmos from any number of perspectives. I wouldn't have written, you know, the majority of the stories in Dwarf House from any number of perspectives. I didn't know there were any.
Did, you know, Ashbery, for instance, sometimes does that with poems, does rewriting paraphrases.
Mm-hmm.
And of course you'd never recognize it the second time round because mm-hmm. the content was not all of that evident the first time. But there are, you can trace yeah. them, pairs of poems that phrase by phrase say the same incomprehensible things.
It's actually sort of wonderful, and I'm a great admirer of Ashbery's. I sometimes fool around deliberately. I mean, the Bob Dylan references and so forth, particular songs, particular singers. I think, you know, some critics who've looked down on this have thought that I was fixated on these particular things. I suppose in the service I am fixated on them, but that's because I want to take the same thing and see what happens not only by changing the context but by going at it 20 years later. You know, who is the Bob Dylan and what is the literary use of that reference in Park City as opposed to the Bob Dylan, you know, that I was invoking 20 years ago? That's changed. That's out of my hands, and people have different opinions, you know, whether I want them to or not. So that's kind of a game with me. I realize I'm doing that.
It's my conviction that as time goes by, these stories, like Eudora Welty's, which at one time were out of print, that these stories will, what is the word, become classics, and that the moments and frenzies of their composition will seem, because of time, necessary. But in the interim, you've been taking a lot of flack, and I've, you know, my feelings about this become very complicated because I do feel, don't they know they're assaulting an extraordinary American writer? I've said this to you in private, and I don't want to embarrass you, but how do you put up with the interim between the time when you're branded as the voice of a generation and the time when you're recognized as being an accomplished writer?
Well, I have to say, I don't say this certainly out of any modesty. It's a genuine belief of mine, but I'm not quite sure how many of these stories are going to be allowed to stand. You know, I'm not as sure as you are at all about whether things endure, and partly that's because, you know, why? Based on worth? I don't think so. I mean, that doesn't seem necessarily to be, you know, the determining factor. And I think maybe in some ways that early labeling was such a liability, frankly, that I can never transcend it. And because I believe that so deeply, why should I give up, you know, the small affects of that, if that isn't what it's about anyway. In other words, why not do what I want to do if they're going to get me anyway, you know? So in some ways, it's really quite reinforcing in terms of taking liberties. No, I really think that for all time, I think that all that nonsense about minimalism that not only I protested, but everybody who was a so-called minimalist protested, that's still there. There's still a big backlash. The critics are too embarrassed to use the word any longer, so they skitter around it. But I think that still there are a number of people who are determined not to read between the lines, not to deal with suggestibility. And unless that sensibility changes, unless there's a different kind of reading, which I don't particularly see coming, I think a lot of, not just my stories, I think a lot of things are going to be lost or misread.
But I think it's somewhat different from that. Like the woman in one of your early stories, which one is it, who blames President Nixon.
Yeah, Wolf for, Dreams.
Yes, mm-hmm. For everything that's going on. I think that people have found a way to blame you for yuppie behavior, as if you weren't reporting it, but creating it, as if you weren't criticizing it, but recommending it. Mm-hmm. And that now, although there has been no subsequent spiritual evolution, people are turning their backs. That was too painful. And, punishing the writer who memorialized it. And that's, I think, more than a mistake about minimalism or how to read between the lines. I think they are punishing you in a form of rejecting the time that the stories report on.
Yeah, I've always been confused about the great extent to which I think I've been confused with, as the writer, I've been confused with the characters in the story. I don't know what to say to account for that. I mean, if I had a more public and transparent life, and if that life really resembled my characters as opposed to being something quite other, I could understand it more. But this is not based, this is based on people's wildest dreams about me, frankly. It's not even based on, the wildest pictures taken in the disco. I'm not in the disco. So how it is that I've become conflated with this thing, I've never been quite sure. But let me tell you, I don't think I'm going to get away from it.
It's my belief that these stories will stand longer than the New Yorker that originally published them, especially as that New Yorker exists now. And, it's my pleasure to recommend to listeners that Park City is a place where you can go to revisit the pleasures of Ann Beatty, the Ann Beatty you've known, to watch her develop and to discover her. Really, one of the extraordinary writers, and funny and graceful and profound and formal, all between two covers. Park City by my guest Ann Beatty. Thank you for joining me.
I'm never leaving the recording studio.
Thank you. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Jennifer Swadek. Special production assistance by Alan Howard and development by Beverly Walker. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with book, off the mouse, pop.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.